I'm Christopher Leiden. This is Open Source. The question here is, what makes prose stylish? Our friend Steve Pinker, the psycholinguist, has written a manual on the subject. He calls it the thinking person's guide to writing in the 21st century. It's a sort of brain scientist's mostly admiring response to E.B. White's immortal Elements of Style, with those venerable rules like omit needless words, which he compiled in the last century from his mentor, William Strunk. The Pinker difference is that he's a brain scientist who knows almost on a first-name basis those neurons in your head that put your language together. We asked Steve to bring along some samples of his favorite lines and paragraphs, and we tried out some of ours on him, too. It became a game of trading passages from William James to Edna O'Brien, Vladimir Nabokov to Roger Angel. It sounded a bit like a trial run for a stage act for grammar nerds, but we invite you to play along with us. Steve can one-up anybody. He can also identify the trope or the trick that makes a piece of prose work or not.
Both of us are fans of William James, and the thing I like about James is not only that he is a brilliant wordsmith, but that while he is doling out this gorgeous prose, he's also making points about our psychology, which continue to be valid today. So here he is, for example, commenting on empathy, on whether you need to get inside someone's head and see the world from their point of view in order to sympathize with them. We supposedly live in an age of empathy, and it's taken for granted that in order to take someone's interests into account, you've got to see the world from their point of view. And James disagrees. Here's what he writes. Take our dogs and ourselves, connected as we are by a tie more intimate than most ties in this world, and yet, outside of that tie of friendly fondness, how insensible each of us to all that makes life significant for the other. We to the rapture of bones under hedges, or smells of trees and lampposts. They to the delights of literature and art. As you sit reading the most moving romance you ever fell upon, what sort of a judge is your fox terrier of your behavior? With all this goodwill toward you, the nature of your conduct is absolutely excluded from his comprehension. To sit there like a senseless statue, when you might be taking him to walk and throwing sticks for him to catch. What queer disease is this that comes over you every day of holding things and staring at them like that for hours together, paralyzed of motion and vacant of all conscious life?
He, like you, of course, is a student of how the mind works, and including the writing mind and the composing mind. He wrote a letter to a Boston artist named Susan Whitman. She had complimented him on his writing. He said, if there is aught of good in the style of it, it is the result of ceaseless toil in rewriting. Everything comes out wrong with me at first, but when once objectified in a crude shape, I can torture and poke and scrape and pat at it till it offends me no more. So many masterful sentences.
Masterful sentences. And again, it's not just that he is a gifted wordsmith, but he's making an important point. And one of the lessons that I hammer on in the sense of style is that most advice on writing really is advice on rewriting. There may be some wordsmiths who can tap out a coherent essay on a first pass. Clearly, there are bloggers and there are columnists on Deadline who have to do that. But for most of us mortals, the excellence comes in the rewriting. And that's because few of us have the brilliance to both get ideas on the page to make some coherent argument and to have the words convey those ideas to a reader in a clear and graceful way.
One last little bit of William James. And here, of course, he's also making a philosophical point, but he's talking about Platonism and the notion of sort of ideas as the thing. And he says, a permanently existing idea, which makes its appearance before the footlights of consciousness at periodic intervals, is as mythological an entity as the Jack of Spades.
It is a wonderful quote that I've used a number of times.
Really?
And it has that bit of surprise. Anyone can say a mythical entity, and anyone can say as mythical as, you know, the Easter Bunny or some cliched allusion like that. But to come up with the Jack of Spades as your example of a mythical entity is a brilliance. It's also reassuring for us mortal writers that if William James can say that he needs to polish and reshape and revise, it gives hope to the rest of us.
Yeah, what a mind. The man who said of his brother Henry, he can do absolutely anything with a story except tell it. unfair, awful, and they loved each other. But, you know, you got us thinking about style. I want in this conversation to sort of not isolate it, but try to define it. You have categories of style, classic style, plain style, postmodernist style. But to me, the objective is to teach us sort of, A, what you know about the brain function of it, but also how to do it. It had us all hunting, though, for our favorite lines. And I want to throw some more at you. Mary McGrath loved that piece by Roger Angel in The New Yorker not so long ago called This Old Man. He's almost 90. He's been writing sports for The New Yorker forever, brilliantly. But this was about just being his age. And here's what he wrote. More venery, as in Venus. More love, more closeness, more sex and romance. Bring it back, no matter what. No matter how old we are, this fervent cry of ours has been certified by Simone de Beauvoir and Alice Munro and Laurence Olivier and any number of remarried or recoupled ancient classmates of ours. Laurence Olivier? I'm thinking of what he says somewhere in an interview. Inside, we're all 17 with red lips.
Wonderful. Just the little surprises, the use of classmates for peers or cohorts, the red lips, the sensory image rather than an abstract description or a cliche like the bloom of youth. These are the signs of a great writer. They keep your visual brain lit up, and they're little surprises. You don't expect the next word that actually appears.
Inevitably, we end up with Nabokov by way of Updike, who said that Nabokov wrote the only way writing should be done ecstatically. What are your favorites?
Well, I'm going to read a description by Humbert Humbert of the Westerns. This is on their cross-country trip with Lolita, and he is immersing himself in American popular culture. And here's his description of what he calls the ox-stunning fisticuffs of the cowboy movies. There was the mahogany landscape, the florid-faced, blue-eyed rough riders, the prim, pretty schoolteacher arriving in Roaring Gulch, the rearing horse, the spectacular stampede, the pistol thrust through the shivered windowpane, the stupendous fistfight, the crashing mountain of dusty, old-fashioned furniture, the table used as a weapon, the timely somersault, the pinned hand still groping for the dropped Bowie knife, the grunt, the sweet crash of fist against chin, the kick in the belly, the flying tackle, and immediately after a plethora of pain that would have hospitalized a Hercules, nothing to show but the rather becoming bruise on the bronzed cheek of the warmed-up hero embracing his gorgeous frontier bride.
You go, Vlad.
Now, that is wonderful writing because it's so visual that, first of all, the long set of phrases joined by commas, which many of the classic style manuals would warn you against, keep your sentences short, he flouts because he is giving you the frenzied mayhem of the Western movie. So he's doing quick camera cuts with the English language. He's not afraid to use alliteration, which a lot of the classic style manuals warn you against. Prim, pretty, schoolteacher, spectacular stampede, plethora of pain that would have hospitalized a Hercules. He's, again, little surprises. The sweet crash of fist against chin. Now, sweet is not the adjective that you would expect there, but because of that perverse delight that we often take in filmed violence, it is an adjective that tells a story.
Because the legend is, and I'm sure it's true, that he wrote those sentences, he composed them, really musically, on 3x5 cards, individually. Every sentence in Lolita was a different 3x5 card.
Well, that was before the age of word processing.
Yeah, you know, thank
now
God.
Now we would just move the sentences around with a few clicks of a mouse.
He wrote an afterword to Lolita, which I adore, and I quote it for many reasons. He's defending the book against the suspicion or the charge that it was pornographic. And he writes, "For me, a work of fiction exists only insofar as it affords me what I shall bluntly call aesthetic bliss. That is a sense of being somehow, somewhere connected with other states of being where art, parenthesis, curiosity, tenderness, kindness, ecstasy, close parenthesis, is the norm."
Wonderful. And in fact, it's not just the reaction of an aesthete, of a literarist, a connoisseur. But I think the pleasure in writing is the first step in becoming a competent writer. Mm-hmm. The problem with a lot of the traditional manuals is that they're stern, they're puritanical. They give a list of errors and sins and pitfalls, whereas almost any other form of mastery that we encounter, photography, cooking, the guides aren't lists of terrible errors that you can make. Mm. They try to kindle an excitement in the craft. And you become a better and better cook or a better and better photographer because you take pleasure in the activity, not because you're tiptoeing through a minefield of errors.
More rules, yeah.
And likewise, the first step in becoming a good writer is to enjoy good writing, enjoy the good writing of others, to stop, linger over passages that tickle the ear, and try to reverse engineer them, try to figure out what it is that the writer did that makes that sentence or that paragraph so good. Yeah. A much more inviting way to master style than avoiding a list of errors, and a necessary one, because a humbling realization that came over me when I began the book is that there is just an infinite set of bits of advice that you could give a writer. Where to begin? How to list them all? And I realized that no writer actually acquires his or her craft by memorizing a list of guidelines. You do it by absorbing vast amounts of good writing yourself. That gives you both a sensitivity to what makes good writing good, and even the errors of punctuation and spelling and word choice are things that good writers avoid simply because they've been so immersed in a world of print that the correct forms are second nature to them. English has so many irregularities and quirks, so many illogical bits of rules of spelling and punctuation that you couldn't possibly memorize them all. You absorb them by reading. Also, a skilled writer has at his or her fingertips a vast number of idioms and constructions and words, which again, you don't pick up by leafing through a dictionary and memorizing them. You pick them up by seeing them in context and in the good writing of others.
Yeah. One last Nabokov line, because to me it's just full of his magic. He was coy about his philosophical, metaphysical, religious beliefs, but he writes at some point, referring to the mystery of what's behind the prose, he's talking about some other plane of awareness, and he seems to be hinting at sort of the opposite side of the tapestry. Here's the line: "I know more than I can express in words, and the little I can express would not have been expressed had I not known more."
There, too, I think he puts his finger on another key principle of style. It's not ultimately about the language itself. It's not about playing with words. But there is a much richer reality of thought, and the language is a window onto that. That if you start writing with the idea that you are just throwing together words as a work of art, you won't be as clear and vivid and enjoyable a writer as if you think that there is a world out there, there is a set of agents doing things, there's a set of emotions, and language is a window onto that independently existing reality.
I have to mention Proust. Not everybody loves Proust. I do. Just on the matter of style, I was thinking, when I was a kid, I read in a sports book that Babe Ruth had said he didn't eat asparagus because it made his pee smell funny. Here's the Proust version of exactly the same notion, but with a twist. He's writing about his boyhood, obviously, in the country, and this comes the season of the asparagus. "But what most enraptured me were the asparagus, tinged with ultramarine and pink, which shaded off from their heads, finely stippled in mauve and azure, through a series of imperceptible gradations to their white feet, still stained a little by the soil of their garden bed, with an iridescence that was not of this world. I felt that these celestial hues indicated the presence of exquisite creatures who had been pleased to assume vegetable form, and who, through the disguise of their firm, comestible flesh, allowed me to discern in this radiance of earliest dawn these hinted rainbows, these blue evening shades, that precious quality which I should recognize again when all night long after a dinner at which I had partaken of them, they played at transforming my chamber pot into a vase of aromatic perfume.
You know, they're both good style.
Exactly.
That's another key lesson about writing. There isn't just a single way to write. And the kind of writing instruction that gives you a template for a 5-paragraph essay can, you know, can turn the writer off writing. And, you know, Babe Ruth had his own poetry in the way he said
Absolutely.
It as well. The wonderful thing also about Proust is that the writing is so visual that you also know what kind of asparagus you're looking at. It's not the American green form, but it's the European white to mauve to purple form, that blanched form that you can only get here in specialty stores. But you know from his words that that's what he's writing about, and you can see every gradation of hue and saturation and lightness.
Yeah,
like
exactly. And then the sort of ease of moving from the sort of synesthesia of going from colors to spirits to smells.
And just so visual. That's one of the greatest sins of writing, is to use abstraction. And this is true not just in florid styles of Proust, but even in plain scientific writing. I think an enormous flaw of technical writing is to use abstractions rather than concrete sensory detail. The same lesson that aspiring novelists are always given, show, don't tell, is just as valid for technical scientific prose.
There's a fundamental question here in the difference, say, between Babe Ruth and Proust on the matter of asparagus and their pea. Harold Bloom is famous for dismissing John Updike, almost, by calling him a minor novelist with a major style. But then you say, wait a sec, what if style is it? I mean, you could almost say it's everything. In identifying the author, that sounds like him, that's Hemingway, that's where he's coming from. I mean, you could argue that Updike's style was the point.
Yes, and that certainly is a difference between literature and, say, science, journalism, polemical or expository prose. You can't just be a stylist and be a competent writer in science or politics or history. You really have to have something to say that's behind the lovely prose. Whereas, of course, the whole point of poetry and of fiction and other literary genres is that style can often be enough. The pleasure that you take in a wordsmith. He's probably being unfair to Updike in terms of as a storyteller too, or as someone who could capture an era and a place. But on top of those gifts that I think Updike did have, you certainly can't gainsay his style.
We've got to talk about science and science writing. And among other things, I'd love your guide to great science writing. You like Brian Greene and others among contemporaries. Some people I don't know, including George Miller. But was there a greater science writer, really, than Darwin? And was the majesty of that Victorian prose, wasn't it up there with his skills as an investigator, as an imaginative reviewer of the evidence?
Well, it certainly was effective in creating the revolution that he wanted to create. His book was a bestseller, as well as having revolutionary and in many ways immortal content. It's unusual, though. The problem with great books curricula as a form of undergraduate education is that it necessarily slights science. A colleague of mine, when asked by a colleague of his at one of the great books universities, what are the great books in science? And he said, there's only been one great book in science, The Origin of Species.
Interesting.
Because the scientific contribution does not need necessarily felicitous style. It helps in spreading the message. But of course, ultimately, it's just the truth of the ideas, the power of the explanation that counts. In the case of Darwin, in the case of William James, there was that happy coupling of genuine content with gorgeous style. But in science, I think there should be more of it, but we can't count on it.
Steve Pinker, spell out some of these different styles that you can recognize from, you know, 100 yards between, say, the plain style in which, as you write, everything is in full view, or the classic style, which is kind of a trick of equalizing speaker and reader in a sort of conversation between one who knows more than the other and is kind of softening the difference. But it is a conversation. And then practical styles, different rhetorical styles, but particularly the postmodern style. I want you to sort of recognize what's going on in a couple of things, you know, totally arbitrary, but that I like as stylistically or stylishly.
This is a taxonomy that I owe to the literary scholars Francis Noël Thomas and Mark Turner in a wonderful book called Clear and Simple as the Truth. Subtitle is Writing Classic Prose. The main point is that any form of writing has to come from some mental model of the way in which the writer is communicating with the reader. Your reader's not there. Writing is an artifice. It's a pretense. You're having a conversation with an imaginary friend. Hmm. But you've got to have a clear image of who that imaginary friend is and what you're trying to accomplish in writing. They note that a style of writing that many of us value, that a lot of us associate with good expository prose, is one that they call classic style, where the model is that the reader and writer are equals. The writer has seen something that the reader has not yet noticed. The writer positions the reader so that she can see it with her own eyes, given that she's been placed so that she has an unobstructed view, and the style is conversation. Now, that's not the only way to write. There's also a contemplative style where a writer does his best to share some ineffable, idiosyncratic, personal perceptions or observations. There's oracular style, where a writer has seen something that no one else can see and tries to convey his vision to an audience. But most of what we appreciate in good essays, in good expositions, in good nonfiction, and even in a lot of good fiction, is classic style. And there the idea is there's an objective reality that exists separately from the writer and the reader, and that the writer is pointing it out to the reader. She is capable of seeing it with her own eyes. It may sound almost too obvious to mention, but they point out that a lot of what makes professional styles, like academies, so insufferable, is that they are written in a self-conscious style, where the goal of an academic is to escape being convicted of philosophical naivete about his own enterprise. And so academic prose is larded with hedges, like somewhat, presumably, with shutter quotes, quotation marks that indicate that the writer doesn't really mean what he's saying.
Right.
With apologies, oh, this is a very complex subject and there's much disagreement and more research needs to be done.
People talk that way too. I call it throat clearing. They do it on the radio. Let's get to the point.
It must be the bane of your existence, people who do that. But the image of an existing reality which you use words to call the reader's attention to cuts through a lot of the turgid verbiage that makes academic prose so tedious. And it fits with a bit of advice that I got from a university press editor when I made this transition from academic writing to more general writing. She said many academics make the mistake that when they write for a broad audience, they condescend. They think they use motherese. They write for a mentally incompetent reader, whereas the right mindset is that your reader is as smart as you are, as intellectually curious as you are, just doesn't know something that you know. So you're just sharing some knowledge, something that you've seen that they haven't seen, but you've got to treat them as an equal. And that was the best single bit of advice I ever got when I made my transition.
Steve, you'll know exactly what I'm reading from, but I want you to tell me what's the style of it and why is it famous and great? Here it is. In the late summer of that year, we lived in a house in a village that looked across the river and the plain to the mountains. In the bed of the river, there were pebbles and boulders, dry and white in the sun, and the water was clear and swiftly moving and blue in the channels. Troops went by the house. We know the rest.
Farewell to Arms, Hemingway. Now, of course, yeah. I can, in all honesty, I can see the title of the book, so I can't brag about my erudition there. That is wonderful writing. Yeah, I don't know how easy it would be to classify it as a style because it's not plain style. The syntax is inverted there. It's not subject verb object consistently. Hemingway is famous for his austerity, parsimony. But that's not plain style. He's playing with the language there. He's not loading up his sentence with lots of adjectives, but there are adjectives in there. And
colors.
There are colors. You can visualize what he's writing about. He is writing partly in reaction to the somewhat flowery, ornate styles of the 19th century, of Proust and James. But it's all good. You don't have to say that one kind of writing is the only way to write. As long as you know what you're doing, as long as you adopt a style, knowing that you are standing in a particular relationship with the reader, you're using language for a certain purpose, and you allow that mental model to guide your decisions as you go. I think the great limitations of a lot of writing advice is that it assumes that there is only a single style. And most of the classic manuals, like Strunk and White's Elements of Style and Ernest Gower's Plain Words, advocate one particular style, plain style, one that avoids playful alliteration and meter that tells the writer to avoid adjectives, to never use a uncommon word when a common word is available. Now, you can see where they were coming from. There is a lot of embarrassing writing where writers reach for words that they barely understand and fall into malaprops, or where the fancy word like utilize is, or employ is used instead of a nice simple word like use. But the judicious choice of a surprising or uncommon word or a vivid adjective is what makes writing enjoyable. And granted, for perhaps a product manual, you want to use plain language, but for other kinds of writing, you can have fun with words. And it's the idea that there are different styles that where you should know which one you're writing in that I think offers the clearest bit of advice. That's also true for rules of usage, for what's correct or incorrect. There's an enormous amount of malarkey that is disseminated about rules of usage where the writer of the guide fails to distinguish correct and incorrect grammar with formal and informal style. So the difference between it's me and it is I, or who are you going to call versus whom are you going to call, or he's a taller man than I, he's a taller man than me. Many examples like that where a lot of the traditional manuals will say one form is correct and the other form is incorrect. And that's wrong. They are both correct in the sense that they are part of the canon of written English, including some of English's best writers. They are immediately recognizable. They are easy to parse. They feel completely natural. They follow the logic of English. But the difference between it is I and it is me is one of formality. If you're aiming for a style that's more at the end of being breezy, chatty, accessible, friendly, as opposed to stuffy, formal, pompous, you choose between them accordingly. You just have to know what you're doing. What kind of style are you aiming at? If you're writing a letter to a close friend, you want a different style than if you're composing an inscription on a genocide memorial. And a good writer has to know the difference between formal and informal style, rather than thinking that the informal style is objectively incorrect.
Deeper into fiction and the emotion, here's Edna O'Brien from a recent book of stories. It's a conversation between cousins in a bitterly divided family. She writes, "We sat in the Jeep because, as he said, we were in no hurry to get home. We didn't talk about family things, his wife or my ex-husband, my mother or his mother, possibly fearing that it would open up old wounds. There had been so many differences between the two families over greyhounds, over horses, over some rotten bag of seed potatoes, and always with money at the root of it. My father, in his wild tempers, would claim that my mother's father had not paid her dowry and would go to his house in the dead of night, shouting up at a window to demand it. Instead, we talked of dogs."
That's wonderful writing, not because of any word choice or sentence structure, but rather it's a window into such a human reality. It's such a true-to-life picture of human nature that we can just imagine people with those motives having that conversation. And a lot of great writing is great not because of the syntactic constructions or word choice, but because it's such a wonderful window into something that we resonate to. In this case, the way that human nature is manifested in banal conversations.
E.B. White, writing that famous book on the elements of style with the ghost of his teacher, Professor Strunk, had a lot of fun with Thomas Paine's famous line. But it raises the question about, isn't style everything? The line being, these are the times that try men's souls. And he played around with it, you know, other ways of saying it. Times like these try men's souls. No. How trying it is to live in these times. No way. These are trying times for men's souls. No. Or soul-wise, these are trying times. Maybe the syntax, the construction is everything in the end.
It is. Well, there it's all. I think it's also the meter. By the way, the reference to soul-wise was one of the peeves of the late 50s and early 60s. This was a construction that everyone attributed to advertising executives, to the madmen. And so it dates the book because that was the obsession of the language purist in those days. But these are the times that try men's souls is lovely, even though it flouts One of the traditional guides of writing is that you don't use things like there are or this is or these are, but there it works. And one of the reasons that it works is it turns the prose into poetry. It has these are the times that try men's souls. It has a lovely meter. And, of course, the sentence ends on the most evocative word, in this case, souls.
Yeah. You're not for lamenting the, you know, what the kids say these days or read or write, but the late, great David Foster Wallace did. He was appalled. He wrote about snoots. He invented the word snoots for syntax nudniks of our time. And he ends his definition of snoot this way. We snoots combine a missionary zeal and near neural faith in our belief's importance with a curmudgeonly hell-in-a-handbasket despair at the way English is routinely defiled by supposedly literate adults, plus a dash of the elitism of, say, Billy Zane in Titanic. A fellow snoot I know likes to say that listening to most people's public English feels like someone using a Stradivarius to pound nails. We are the few, the proud, the more or less constantly appalled at everyone else. What about the misuse? Maybe the decline, maybe the terminal decline of language in this visual culture.
Yes, I know. I have little patience for that style of language lamentation, because it's ignorant. It is not holding yourself to high standards to repeat what every generation has said about the imminent decline of the language. For one thing, you are saying something that is false. The language is not continuously declining. If the snoots of the past generations were correct, we'd be grunting like Tarzan right now, which we're not. Also, it shows a lack of intellectual curiosity. That is, who decides what's right and wrong? The answer is no one, or all of us. There is no tribunal of the English language that actually rules on what's correct or incorrect. Mm. And so there is no objective sense in which someone who uses a form that grates on a purist's ear is actually incorrect. Now, there is a consensus. There are tacit conventions of language. Dictionaries try to capture them. But dictionary editors are completely aware that what they're doing is they are tapping into the ears of a virtual community of writers, which can change over time. The way I put it is when it comes to the English language, there's no one in charge. The lunatics are running the asylum. Mm. If you don't realize that, you don't understand how language works. And you're apt to give ham-fisted advice. So in the guise of high standards and intellectual excellence, the purists are actually making one blunder after another because they rely on their own intuitions and on their status as writers and on their emotion of anger rather than actually being scholars and looking stuff up, like seeing where does the alleged rule against using disinterested to mean bored come from. Is it really a recent deterioration, or have people been doing it for centuries? What was the original meaning of disinterested? Was it unbiased, or was it bored? These are the kind of questions you can actually answer if you go to a reference book and you look up the scholarship, people who actually study language for a living and know what they're talking about. But to base your judgments of what's happening to the language on your own subjective impressions is to be an ignoramus. It's not to uphold high standards. It's to do the opposite. It's to substitute emotions and snobbery for accuracy and scholarship.
Steve, you're the brain scientist and wonderful writer. Have we answered the fundamental question that was on my mind, which is what makes it stylish, the writing we like?
I wish there were more rigorous science on this. The problem is that my tribe, the psycholinguists who study language in the lab, tend to look at the most prosaic, boring forms of language imaginable. And if you ask a typical psycholinguist what makes a sentence easy to understand, they'll say, well, every word is predictable in context. And there's a sense in which that's true, that certainly you whip your way through the end of the sentence very quickly that way, but it precisely misses what gives us such delight in language, such as the examples that you and I have traded over the course of this conversation, where it's the surprising low-frequency word, the one that makes your brain give a little electrical jolt that gives a lot of the pleasure in writing. So there's a little less science than I would like, but the nice thing about style, about language, and about a lot of psychology is that all of us can kind of do it in the armchair because we can tap our own reactions. We can all agree, and I can see this in audiences when I give the talk. If you give a stuffy, bloated sentence and a lean, clear alternative, everyone recognizes it as an instant. That's an experiment. And so a lot of the advice that I give is based on the kind of experiment that we can all do from our armchair, namely everyone agrees that this is a good sentence and that's a bad one.
Steve, we've been doing it for 20 years. Let's keep doing it. Thank you so much for what you add. And don't we all want to do it better? Thank you.
Thank you.
Mary McGrath produced and edited this conversation with Steven Pinker. His book is called The Sense of Style. We're asking listeners to add your own favorite examples of perfect prose on our website, radioopensource.org. You'll find lots more of this kind of conversation on the site. Please subscribe to all our podcasts at iTunes. And thank you for being part of the Open Source Podcast Project. I'm Christopher Leibman.